I'm interested in with what mind and what imagination and thoughts and association one person lives her life. And that's the common thread in all three novels. And that's, of course, what interests me as a psychoanalyst, practicing psychoanalysis, doing psychoanalytic work, and also what interests me in terms of psychoanalytic theory. What goes on in the mind? That's an endlessly fascinating question that I have.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully the worst is over and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Cordelia Schmidt-Hellerow. In today's conversation, we consider the many ways that Cordelia expresses her immersion in the world of psychoanalysis. She is a novelist, she is a theoretician, and she's also the chair of the IPA in Culture Committee. And we take up each one of these facets of her work and we find the threads that connect them. Certainly, the visual orientation is important in all of them. In her novel, which she will read an excerpt from, we learn about the conflicts overseeing, both the wish and the taboo and the punishment overseeing. And she talks to us also about the value of linking words with images that we see, that makes it more available to our secondary processes. In her theoretical work, she emphasizes the self-preservative drive. It's a redoing of Freud's aggressive drive, and to my ears, it has a great deal of clinical utility. And we also discuss her work as the IPA in Culture Chair. And that committee put together one of the three books that we discussed today, which was an edited volume consisting of the winners of a short story prize. She sent out an invitation to IPA analysts asking them to contribute short stories. She had an overwhelming response. Many hundreds of people sent in submissions. They were blindly reviewed. And the book publishes 30 of them. And we go into this in detail. Cordelia is a training and supervising analyst at the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, as well as on the Swiss Psychoanalytic Society. She has written a number of books. The novel we speak about is called Memory's Eyes, a New York Oedipus novel, but it's only one of three of her novels. The first one was written in German, and the third one, which is on its way to be published, is called Memento. The metapsychology collection of papers, it's called Driven to Survive, published in 2018, and it was a finalist in the American Board and Academy of Psychoanalysis Book Prize. And as I said, she is the chair of the IPA and Culture Committee. She is in private practice in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. I found our conversation to be a learned one. There were things that I hadn't thought about. I've become acquainted with them in reading her work to my benefit. And I hope you find it as enriching as I did. It's an important and I found satisfying conversation. Here is my conversation with Cordelia Schmidt-Hillero. Cordelia, welcome to the podcast. It's so good to have you here. Cordelia, I'm sitting here with three of your books. The first is one of your novels called Memory's Eyes, a New York Oedipus novel. The second is a collection of your theoretical papers, aptly called Driven to Survive. And the third is an edited compilation of short stories called The Analyst as Storyteller, which you and a group of you put together. It was a contest for analysts around the world to submit short stories, and you received a very large number of submissions and in a blind evaluation, settled on 30, which are in this book. And, you know, reading these works of yours brought to mind sort of an old image of a hologram, a computer-generated image that's on a screen. And if you pick out one little piece of the hologram and display it on its own screen, it reveals the entire original screen. And that came to mind because each one of these aspects of your psychoanalytic mind is both distinct and also relates to the whole. And two of the themes that impressed itself on me in reading these works is, number one, the importance of the visual, the eyes, the seeing, and, of course, the importance of the drives. So starting off with the novel, I have to say that it really, you know, the expression is it's a page-turner. It's a page-turner with surprise, shocking ending that we obviously won't reveal, but we'll tease the audience with. It's a wonderful read, and the visual is throughout it. And not only is it the excitement of seeing, the forbiddenness of seeing, the punishment of blindness, all familiar to us from the Oedipus story, set in modern days now. There are even Fellini references in there, if there weren't enough visual references. But the story is so rich, I don't think it's fair to say it could only have been written by an analyst, but it certainly helps because you live in the mind of your protagonist through which the story is told. How about if you start us off by telling us what it's like to be an analyst novelist and how that lives for you and how they work together, how they reflect a certain sensibility that you bring to yourself and understanding people.
Harvey, first of all, let me say I'm touched about your interest that you dived obviously into these three books and you come up with the essentials of it. So you made me actually also think again about what is the common thread here in my mind when I do these different things. And one thing is certainly true throughout my life. I always enjoyed writing, the play with words. Etymology interested me, the sound of words. So I started actually very early in my life. At 11, I wrote my first novel. And I thought I'll become a novelist. And then I also became interested in psychoanalysis when I was 17 and got Freud's outline on psychoanalysis. So I wavered a little bit, a novelist or a psychoanalyst. And I tried my hand in writing a novel when I was about 20. And I couldn't do it. And in retrospect, I think I was a bit depressed at the time. And so I thought, I'm not a storyteller. I continued to enjoy writing and I became an analyst, writing psychoanalytic texts and books. And two analyses and some decades later, I thought, well, why not try it again? And it's only now that I really totally enjoy writing fiction. There is, you know, this idea that psychoanalysis destroys the writer's capacity to write. And I think the total opposite is true. And that brings me to the specifics of what you noticed, the visual. You know, my three novels that I've written, Memories, Eyes, as you mentioned, my first novel that was published in German, Rousseau's Dream, and my third novel that I just finished, Memento, they all are about the memory, the dreaming, what goes on in the mind of a person. And that makes me a psychoanalyst writer. I'm actually only interested in what goes on in the mind of a person. I'm not so much interested as a fiction writer in drafting a story, let's say, a spy story or a mystery story or even a family history with the things that supposedly happen. I'm interested in with what mind and what imagination and thoughts and association one person lives her life. And that's the common thread in all three novels. And that's, of course, what interests me as a psychoanalyst, practicing psychoanalysis, doing psychoanalytic work, and also what interests me in terms of psychoanalytic theory. What goes on in the mind? That's an endlessly fascinating question that I have. So that's what makes me a most adventurous writer. Even as reading fiction, I'm always interested in weird minds, in a sort of strange thinking, because that's a wonderful challenge for me to understand, why is this person thinking that way?
You know, let me share with the listeners an exchange you and I had that comes to mind now because of where you say you're interested in how the mind works. You and I had a conversation before this one where that's being taped, and we were going over your books, and in the theoretical book, we were discussing what case would be best to present to illustrate the points that the book is organized around. And I had suggested a particular case, and you said, let me think about it. And you got back to me, and you wrote, and you said, you know, I understand why you chose that case. It offers this, and it shows that, and it is helpful in this way. But let me make another suggestion. And you did, and we will. But that little could be seen as an innocuous exchange, but of course it wasn't. At that moment, I felt understood by you in a way that wasn't necessary. You could have said, you know, I thought about it and I think this other one would be better, but you didn't. You understood how you imagined, and fairly correctly, you understood how I was approaching it. And then you added your suggestion. And it really revealed a great deal about your mind and how you relate to others and how you're interested in how they think. And I was touched by it and also learned something about you by it. So I'm giving a confirming association to what you just said about your interest in people's minds.
Yes, I can see this, and I'm glad you took it that way. But I also noticed that I haven't fully responded to your first question, which was about the seeing, the images, right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
And so that is interesting in itself, too. I think thinking in images is probably the most comprehensive and evocative mode of our thinking, but it's also vague in a productive way, vague. For instance, the best example would be the dream. If we dream, each element of a dream can mean many things. And so we don't quite know what it actually means in this particular moment. And then we tell the dream and we say, for instance, I dreamt about this house. And the word house already limits it. It is then a house. Even though when we then associate, it may turn out that the house actually stands for the body or for many other things. And so in that sense, when we work with images, we need to put words to them. If we don't tell a dream, the dream will be lost. It fades away. It evaporates. Mm. If we tell the dream, we can remember it. And so I think that's the basic idea that Freud had in his essay on the unconscious. When we want to make something conscious, then we need to put words to the images, the thing representations and the word representations, as you said, need to come together. And I think fiction writers do just that. They use word to create images, or they try to find words to talk about the images that are emerging in them. Mm-hmm. That's why I think reading and writing fiction will be always a creative process. The analyst, for instance, when listening to what the patient says, to the narrative, needs to imagine what the patient tells you. And we can even see on the quality of the images that come up in us, the quality of the patient's mind, how it works. So there are patients who tell you something and you see it in front of your eyes, the whole situation, whether it is accurately that the patient describes or not. There are other narratives that elicit very little images. And that also could make you think about the working of the mind of the patient. So,
and there's also the experience of patients wanting to share literal images with us.
Yes, that is also interesting. They do it in particular since all images now are on the iPhone.
Right,
and,
sure.
Here and pulls it out, which may be a loss in some ways because they don't need to use words to communicate the image that they have in mind. And in the end, it's more interesting what they have in mind than what they have on screen. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of images, how about if you read an excerpt from the novel? It's a graphic one in that it's a lot of visual, a lot of excitement, a lot of tumult, and it'll give the listeners a real taste of how you paint a picture, and some of the images and experiences that the book generates.
I would love to do that. May I first say a bit about what the novel is about?
Because, yeah, sure. Yeah.
So this novel is an Oedipus novel. I have used the three Sophocles plays, Oedipus Rex, Oedipus at Colonus, and Antigone, to tell the old Oedipus myth in the version that Sophocles left us. And of course, with the mind of an analyst and the meaning of the Oedipus complex in psychoanalysis. And I tell a story that is contemporary and takes place in New York. It's a story of a young woman, Anne, who is in her early 30s, and she is a candidate at a psychoanalytic institute in New York. And the novel starts out with her boyfriend, who is a jazz player, and who wants to travel with his band around the world. And before he leaves, he asks her, "Who are you?" And this seemingly strange question is, of course, also the question of the Delphi Oracle. "Who am I?" Is what Oedipus asks the Oracle. And it's a question that we all, sooner or later, have to answer for ourselves. Who am I? And in the novel, it sets off thinking, sets Anne on a path of thinking about her family and how all her family story unfolded. And that's how the novel starts. And the piece that I want to read is from this first part where she tries to figure that all out. She imagines how her father and her mother and her family lived before she was even born. Okay. You may also need to know that Eddie, her father, is living with his girlfriend at the time, Joyce, in a small apartment on Fifth Avenue. And Eddie has a knack for odd or crooked toys. And he is a toy collector and started a business as a toy company called Fix It. And one of his great toys that was very successful right at the beginning is the Magic Man. It's an assemblance of different parts that you can take apart and put together again in different ways. It can become a woman, or it can become a car or an animal, whatever. So that is, of course, a very magic thing to do. And one morning, he is sitting with his girlfriend Joyce at breakfast. The doorbell rings, and a former college teacher arrives. It's a college teacher with whom he had a passionate affair, brief and passionate. And she comes with a little boy about 6 years old, Paul. And she says, this is your son. Eddie had no idea that she had a son out of this affair. And she is diagnosed with late stage cancer and will die. And she says, now you have to take over. And so that's what happens. And it's, of course, an awfully difficult situation for all involved. Little Paul moves in, is difficult, and is put in a boarding school during the week. And on the weekend, he is at home with Eddie and Joyce. So here is how Anne imagined that, how that went. I read. At his first Christmas in New York, when Paul presented Eddie with a broken fire engine that he had tried to fix with cardboard, Eddie immediately gave it a depreciative look, and his first thought was, Paul just gives me what is broken, the things he cannot use anymore. But maybe Paul gave him what was broken because he hoped that his father could fix it. In fact, Paul had carefully studied Eddie's toy collection and noticed that all the items were crooked and broken or oddly fixed, and he had taken great care in patching the fire engine to fit Eddie's standard. Somehow Eddie must have liked it anyway, because it ended up in his collection. However, more often than not, Eddie got irritated with Paul, in particular when Paul acted against the basic family rules. For instance, Paul left his dirty sneakers and filthy socks wherever he took them off, dropped half of his clothes that were supposed to go into the laundry basket on the living room carpet, and stacked the bathroom and kitchen corners with his tattered comic books and kids' magazines, thus edging the ugly trace of rebellion in Eddie's need for an orderly, comfortable, and aesthetic world. Knowing how allergic Eddie was to this mess, Joyce hurried to pick up Paul after Paul, collected, folded, organized, and piled up what he dumped down, only to see the whole place cluttered again shortly after. Eddie hated how Joyce enslaved herself to Paul's obnoxious behavior and told her to stop it. Joyce defended her actions by putting forward that she only did this because Eddie was such a control freak and she wanted to avoid getting into a fight about it, which, however, was exactly what they did. He should clean up his mess, Eddie stated. Give him a break, Joyce demanded. He is little and has to adjust to a lot of changes right now. When they got into these fights, Paul seemed to gleefully watch them argue. With an air of innocence, he then would ask Joyce if she could help him with his schoolwork, and when she agreed and sat down with him at the window table, Paul would slowly shuffle his chair close beside hers, and eventually, Eddie had no idea how, managed to sit on her lap, leaning his head at her bosom and rubbing his naked foot at her thigh, seemingly lost in thought. To see the two of them enjoying their homey intimacy under the pretense of doing schoolwork needled Eddie with jealousy. "He's nearly 8 years old," he reprimanded Joyce later. "It's totally inappropriate that he would sit on your lap like a baby." But Joyce only laughed at him and called him prudish, which offended Eddie, since it seemed to be Joyce who had grown distant and prudish over the weekends, ever since Paul had walked in on them one night when they had been having sex. He seemed to have stood there in the door watching them for quite a while before his cold feet betrayed him with a sneeze, and Eddie and Joyce discovered the intruder. Eddie was furious. He could have killed Paul right on the spot. He would at least have belted him one, hadn't Joyce, despite her nakedness, held him back and scantily covering herself by pulling the bedsheet around her, a move that momentarily exposed Eddie and his still erect penis to Paul's hostile inspection, she rushed over and brought little Paul to his room, staying there for a long time, softly talking with him until Eddie got so frustrated that he got himself a beer, lit a cigarette, something they had actually agreed on not doing when Paul was with them, and flipped through the TV program in search of an action movie. "Fuck it," Eddie thought, "fuck it." Later, Joyce joined him, and for a while they watched this boring movie about a serial killer who slaughtered prostitutes in the neighborhood of where he had grown up and was chased by a gang of pimps as well as a squad of police detectives, just the usual thing. When the movie stopped for a commercial break, Joyce said, "I'm sorry for the interruption." "It wasn't you who interrupted," Eddie retorted. "I know," Joyce said, "but I stayed too long. I wanted to talk with him. I think I understand him." "So what do you understand?" Eddie charged. "Let's not talk about this now," Joyce cautioned. Silently and without touching, they continued sitting next to each other, lonely and hurt, staring at the TV screen, both lost in their own meandering worries.
Thank you for that. Thank you for reading it as beautifully and really enticing us. If I were listening and didn't know, I would want to know right now the name of the book you just read. So I'll act on that assumption. It's called Memory's Eyes, a New York Oedipus novel. It's so evocative. It's so present. It's so carefully and beautifully and gracefully drawn. We could spend the rest of our time on this, and I'm tempted to, but there are other things in this hologram that I want us to get to, because your vision is broader than just a novelist. And that is your theoretical work. And your theoretical work, as I mentioned, is in a collected volume, Driven to Survive. And you make the case, and it's ostensibly unpopular, at least in the States, about the importance of drives, or otherwise known as instincts. And what I understand you to be saying, and you're going to have to flesh this out for me and us, is that you want to underline the importance of the preservative drive. Preservative drive could also be called the caretaking drive, but not as it relates to libidinal strivings, but as a separate drive, as a better representation of the aggressive drive. And how you think of it both in theory and how it expresses itself clinically. And we're going to do both, but let me start by reading just a few sentences on it to introduce it, and then I'll ask you to flesh it out. You write, "We begin with and maintain Freud's assumption of a life drive and a death drive, both striving virtually endlessly, each in its own direction, one toward eternal life and the other toward final death. We conceive of the infant's hunger as a sense of starvation, eliciting the fear of death. It is then the interference of the nursing object that stops this rush towards death, and introduces for the first time what self-preservation is at this point, namely being fed, held, kept clean, and safe. Thus, it is the object that introduces self-preservation by structuring and limiting the death drive and building protective screens against the surge towards death, screens that define the specific functions of the preservative drive. Tell us more about this and how you see it as relating to what people call aggression.
Yeah, you know, Freud started out when he drafted his theory of how the mind works with two basic antagonistic drives, the sexual and the self-preservative drives. And he took this from Darwin. He said the drives provide the mind with energy. The drives are related to bodily functions, and the drive is basically the body's demand on the mind. So this is what gets us going. The structures are built in the experience with the environment. The structures are basically the memory traces of what we have encountered from early on. And so we could say without the drives, we would not want anything. And without the structures, we wouldn't know what we want. And so in that sense, I think these two notions, the drives with their energies and the structures who balance these energies and direct them, these are the two basic notions with which he built his whole theory. And in that sense, I know that people got away from drive theory, which always puzzled me, and I think it's really a grave loss, even in psychoanalysis. I think we cannot do without the drives. And so in his first theory, he put self-preservation and sexuality as these basic drivers of mental life without paying much attention to self-preservation. He was very much interested in elaborating on the sexual drive, but he never discarded the self-preservative drive. And then in 1920, he came up with this theory of life and death drive. And he struggled in his paper, Beyond the Pleasure Principle, how to transition his first drive theory into the second drive theory, because sexuality, of course, fit very well into a life drive. But the opposite, the antagonist, the self-preservative drive, didn't seem to fit into a death drive. And so he ended up putting the self-preservative drive into the life drive as well, and created aggression as the representative of the death drive. This never really made sense to me, because if aggression would be a primary drive, that would mean we would have the inclination to destroy just in order to destroy something, which is not a good evolutionary strategy.
And something we don't see clinically.
Right, exactly. And so I went through this whole metapsychology for basically two decades to figure out all the moments where Freud got distracted or led astray, even by the notion of life and death and self-preservation. And what I understood in the end, and how I revised it, I said, well, in the beginning, everything is about life and death. And the idea of a self-preservative drive insinuates that it would go without saying that we have that. We don't have and know what self-preservation is until we learn it. And this is already something that the object brings into our mind. It structures the primarily wild striving of life and death. It structures these primary drives and introduces sexuality and self-preservation, and later then self and object preservation, because drives can be directed to the self, but also to any object. And in the end, you know, it always puzzles me how psychoanalysis could forget about self-preservation, self and object preservation, this urge to survive, this wildly being driven to do everything we can to survive, as a primal drive. Every day that we live, we think about these things. Do I take a coat when I go out in winter or not? Will I be warm enough or too warm? Do I have something to eat, the right thing to eat? Am I sick? Should I risk this or that? So all these thoughts go into preserving myself, but also the object. We need to, and we have a primal urge to preserve our object. Think about these moving reports from war zones, when parents throw themselves in front of their children and take the bullet and die just to preserve their children. That's an urge that's so primal. And I think we need also to distinguish self and object preservation from self and object love. The errors that we put into loving an object and having fun with the object or narcissistically investing in ourselves is very different from taking care of an object and of ourselves. So it's a joy and sorrow, as Damasio made the distinguished between the two primal urges in human life. It's not love and hate. It's joy and sorrow, I think.
And just to build on what you're saying, there's new biological and epidemiological findings that say the best way we can care for ourselves in older age is by having a social community that we care about.
Yeah.
And it's a better predictor of a long, healthy life than your cholesterol or your blood pressure, how warmly you hold and are part of a community. Yes. Which is what you're saying. Can you say a little bit about how you see this preservative drive different among men and women?
Yes. Just let me add one moment that I think is also important for aging well. Yeah. Because I think the caretaking and the community is good, but also the libidinal investment in the world. Older people have the tendency to shrink their environment more and more. They got less invested in politics, in culture, in the world at large, and even in terms of their mobility, they shrink back to their primary community and then to their house and then to one room in the house. Mm. We can steer a little bit against it in keeping our interest in politics, in culture, in literature, in the other, in a new person that comes into our life. That's a libidinal investment that also helps us staying alive and mobile in older age. But to get back to your question, I just forgot.
About men and women, how the preservative drive lives differently.
Right. it's nowadays considered as politically incorrect to have a distinction, but I do think there are distinctions. I think men and women both are important caretakers, but their tendencies seem to be a bit different. I'm not saying this in absolute terms, but in tendential terms. Uh-huh. Women are more concerned with the hygiene, with the indoor activities. This is the old image of the woman takes care of the house and the man hunts for food. Hunting for food is, of course, also preservative, but and defending against enemies is preservative. But it is in a more muscular, I would say, defense. There's this one little example that I found so telling, where a little child was stung by bees, by a bee's nest, and that was, of course, terrible, and she was very anxious. The mother was sitting with her and talking through this whole example and cooling her hurting foot. And the father was plotting how to take revenge, how she could learn to defend herself in future about something that really affected her. So in that sense, I think there are different functions in men and women, not in absolute terms, but tendentially, how to teach our children to preserve themselves and preserve their objects.
It's a wonderful example in the book, and it's fleshed out with more nuance how lucky that little girl was to have parents who covered the waterfront from the tender holding, protecting, to the let's honor your revenge aspects too, and we'll do that as well. And it was a very full picture. Before we go to the clinical example, there is something about understanding aggression in its defensive aspects that grows out of your theoretical work. And I think that warrants mentioning. Can you say something about that?
Yeah. After having reintegrated the preservative drives into the death drive and the second drive theory, of course, now I needed to understand aggression. How does aggression fit into this theory? And I went back to Freud's 1909 remark, where he said both drives need to have the capacity to become aggressive in order to be successful. So if our preservative or our sexual drives are interfered with, they need to overcome the obstacle in order to be successful. And that made total sense to me. Now, the obstacle can be a real interference with our wish to survive or our wish to love. And then we need to become aggressive. If we don't, that's a problem that we would analyze. If we have no real obstacle, the obstacle may be in our mind. We may have a transference on our objects that they never let us live or never let us love as much as we want to. And that's, of course, what analysts have to deal with the transferential idea that is carried into the world and leads me to be aggressive where I do not have to be aggressive. Aggression is always about an idea that I have that makes me anxious, that threatens me in my primary goals. And that's what I think needs to be addressed.
So when we hear in clinical conferences where it is being suggested that all that's needed is the patient to be aware of how angry they felt. Yes, it is valuable to be aware of how angry one felt, but my understanding is that you're suggesting further that the next step is to see what it is that made you so angry. Was there a hurt? Was there a disappointment? Was there a frustration? Was there a fantasy thwarted? But that just being aggressive and angry is not bedrock, as it is said.
Yeah, absolutely. So we sometimes hear in clinical presentations, the patient need to own his aggression, or right. What about his aggression, as if this were a thing in itself. And this idea that aggression is a thing in itself goes back to 1920 Freud, where he then settled with this idea, aggression is a primary drive expressing the death drive. If we don't see aggression that way, but understand that aggression is always about something else, then we start analyzing. Then we are curious what kind of idea made it necessary for the patient to become so aggressive.
Can you give us a clinical example of how this lives in the office?
When you asked me to prepare a clinical example, I thought of Jane, because the example of Jane in my paper, Fighting with Spoons, uh-huh. lends itself to the preservative drives and to aggression. So we can cover basically uh-huh. both.
Yeah, let's do it.
Example. And so Jane was a patient in her 30s who came to me because she always ran into difficulties, in particular with women colleagues, for instance, also friends, and most notably with her mother. She had a lively and creative side. She could be funny, but she was also highly guarded and suspicious and stubborn and prickly. So it was a very mixed picture that she presented when she came first in. I learned that she was the only child of her mother. Her mother had gotten her very late in her 40s and had basically immediately after Jane was born divorced her father. So she grew up basically raised by a single mother. And the single mother, she had worked a lot to make ends meet and was always exhausted, was worried in particular about her daughter's health, about her eating, did she have enough? So the whole upbringing of Jane was about caretaking issues, and overwhelmingly so. When Jane came to me, her mother had just moved into an assisted living place a few blocks close to where Jane lived. And now there was a whole battle unfolding day after day. Jane wanted to do something good for her mother. She bought her food, or she organized a doctor's appointment. She wanted to clean her room. And Jane's mother always fought against it. You worked so hard. It will exhaust you. Don't do this. And I'm not hungry. Please take the food back with you. And Jane got frustrated, and they got into these fights, and tears were rolling. It was painful to listen, even to me as an analyst. It went over and over. Basically, who took better care of the other? Who was allowed to take better care of the other? We have to understand that taking well care of another is also satisfying. So there is also a pleasure in being a good caretaker that is that one feels deprived of if the other doesn't let you. So both participants in the struggle became angry at each other. And also the anger was not only in being deprived of the pleasure, but because of the increasing worries about the other. The other, it was as if the other couldn't survive if each of them wouldn't be allowed to do this caretaking stuff. It would perhaps go too far to say that this, of course, also entered the transference. Partly she was feeding me with lots of stuff as a mother. Partly she behaved like a daughter who was so hungry. It was a complicated situation. And both transferences led then to aggressive enhancement of what they wanted to get through. So I think in this example, we can see that the whole caretaker issue is an issue that our patients are driven to. It's an incredibly powerful urge. And if they are not aware of what they try to fight off, basically the fear of death or the fear of starvation or the fear of the other getting sick and disintegrating, then we may miss out on structuring these basic primal strivings and allowing them to move over into a more pleasurable, more erotic life.
How does what you're describing, how is it similar to but different from
a way of thinking about what you described in terms of enmeshment and separation and individuation, allowing more libidinal aspects of the development to take shape.
Separation and individuation is a structural issue. So if we think of the infant starting out with self and object being just one structure that eventually is separated out in two different units, the self-representation and the object representation, with all the anxiety that provokes mm-hmm. such a separation, then we can say both drives, again, activate the self and the object. I can be self-preservative or object preservative. I can be object preservative so much so that it is at the expense of my self-preservation. Or on the sexual side, I can invest in myself, that's narcissism. I can invest in the object, that is object love, and I can invest so much in myself that it is at the expense of the object, or I can invest in the object by idealizing the object so much that it is depriving my narcissistic investment. So separation and individuation are structural issues, while the two drives say tell you with what kind of energy these structures are activated. Mm-hmm.
Again, I find myself wanting to go further and further in this, but there's more territory we have to cover. I'm looking at your third book here, The Analyst as Storyteller, and that involves your work as the chair of the IPA in Culture Committee, along with many people who work with you. Tell us about this project, both briefly the mechanics of it, because that in itself is quite an effort, but your thinking about the title, The Analyst as Storyteller, and how it's also written in Spanish as well.
Well, maybe it has a little bit to do with my discovering fiction writing and what a pleasure it is. And then when I was talking a little bit with colleagues, realizing that other colleagues also enjoy fiction writing. Mm-hmm. And I think fiction writing is such a creative process, but has actually no place in our community. In distinction, for instance, to writing psychoanalytic papers, there are journals. You can publish your papers and communicate in that way. So I thought with my committee, why not launching a short story contest? And we were so surprised and so pleased when 250 colleagues sent their short
That's really
stories.
Quite something, yeah.
Yeah, and from
40 countries, isn't that right?
40 countries, yeah. It was sort of around the world. And they all said it was so much fun and pleasure. And actually, they asked us to do this again. And we created a jury, blind read these stories, and came up with the 30 best that we published in this book. And not only did we want to present the analyst as storyteller, but we also wanted to honor the different languages. The IPA is an international organization, and many languages are spoken there. And in particular, in writing fiction, it is important to write in one's own language. And so we managed to print these stories in their original languages, but in order to make them accessible to most of our colleagues, we also translated them into English and Spanish in case they were written in a different language. And so we have many languages, but always English and Spanish. So I think most colleagues or readers can access these stories.
Hmm. Speaking of many languages, could you I didn't know of your past. I know of your accent, and that was all I knew of you. I didn't know where you trained. I have since learned, but I think it would be useful for our listeners to get to know you a little bit about your background. You add to your experience here in the States by having trained elsewhere. And I wonder what that's like. But tell us a little bit about your professional journey and how that plays a role in how you are now an analyst.
Yeah, sure. I was born and went to school in Germany and then moved to Switzerland, where I finished my studies at the time, literature, philosophy, and psychology. And that's where in Zurich I trained at the Swiss Psychoanalytic Society. And, you know, Switzerland is also a multilingual country. Our two main languages there are German and French. And so in my training, I had a strong influence of German Anglo-Saxon psychoanalysis on the one hand and French psychoanalysis on the other. Our French colleagues are the majority, so the influence of French psychoanalysis was very heavy.
Was there any influence by the strong Jungian presence in Zurich?
Not at all. The Jungians are probably the bigger group in Zurich. Jung has a house there on the Zurich Lake. But even though they sometimes invited us to present something, Freudians are not really interested, I think, in Jungian psychoanalysis.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I personally cannot read Jung. I didn't like his biography, his way of treating Freud. So I'm not into Jungian.
That's a no, right? Okay.
There you already have the multilingual approach, French and German at least, in mm-hmm. our Swiss Psychoanalytic Society. And there is a strong hold on Freud, both in the German original and also in the French take on it. So that certainly was welcome to me because I came to psychoanalysis by being enamored in Freud's writing and thinking. So that fit very well to my training. I became a training and supervising analyst at the Swiss Society before I moved to this country. And now I'm a training and supervising analyst at the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, and bring there my perhaps odd thinking about classical psychoanalysis and Freud. And
does it feel odd? Is that your personal experience, that as an outsider trained elsewhere, that you feel that it's an odd perspective?
I assume that some people feel this is odd or old-fashioned or not up to date, but I do experience whenever I teach Freud or metapsychology or drive theory to candidates, it makes perfect sense to them. It does make sense to them, and I think it's a little bit unfortunate that the candidates are too quickly perhaps led away from Freud, or Freud is made just one under many equally valuable voices. I still think even if one wants to, it will end up as a Kleinian or as a relational analyst or Winnicottian or Bionian, to have a solid basis in Freud is tremendously important. And so in that sense, I don't feel ashamed to hold on to Freudian thinking. And I actually think Freud can still, he missed many things during his writings, but he can still stimulate us so much. If ever anybody wants to write something and doesn't know what to write about, I say, open Freud at any place and read three pages and you have your subject to write about and to develop. And so in that sense, it's okay. But maybe what you pick up on is that I still am in the business of translation. not only German to English or English to German, as I do with my fiction, but also Freud to contemporary psychoanalysis, or of course the patient's thinking and associations to his or her transference and the unconscious. That's always our job.
You know, when we first started our conversation today, I identified two themes that ran through your work, the visual and the drives. And to be more complete, there is a third theme. And let me quote you. This was a letter you wrote to candidates. In just one sentence, you write, "Which other profession would allow you to linger on dreams, to look at their intricate layers of meaning, and enjoy the beauty, wit, and even the archaic bluntness of their imagery? Because this complexity is what makes psychoanalysis such an intriguing profession, it is obviously a daunting task to study it." And what I take from that sentence, Cordelia, is not just your interest in the visual and the jives, but your deep immersion in the world of psychoanalysis, your profound personal pleasure in it, and intellectual pleasure. And so, like you say with Freud, if you open them up anywhere, you can find something enriching to write about, to discover. And I hope this isn't embarrassing, but speaking to you about any one of a number of subjects does the same. If we start a conversation, it will reveal something that will engender thought in us and a new way of looking at it. Odd, I don't know if it's odd, but refreshing and different, and it gives one something to think about. And that's been my pleasure in reading your work and in our conversations. And I'm sure that's going to be the case for our listeners. And I want to thank you. I want to thank you for participating in this, for the work you've contributed, for now I can't wait till your third novel gets published, and perhaps we'll visit again. But thanks so much for spending this time and for and sharing your wisdom.
Thank you, Harvey, for having me. It was a pleasure to talk with you and to exchange what we are thinking in with words. So it's the images and the words that came together. It was. I'm very happy to have had this conversation.
Me as well. Thanks. Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.